Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, it's Bao and Chris here. It's literally Gaysians,
and we're talking about food on here today, the perennial favorite topic of all Asian people.
I'm sure everyone has seen the block-long lines of Asian folks, especially young ones, outside of the latest hotspot delicacy. I still can't get over our day-long group chat of our friends trying to get a cronut, a fucking cronut.
And my mom has always like made this problematic joke about Chinese people, telling me that Chinese people don't have emotions, but the only emotions they have are for money and food.
I still remember the first time you said that, and I wanted to like respond and be mad, but I couldn't because it described me to a T.
Also, you make fun of Vietnamese people so much. Like, I have that one joke, and I'm going to use that one joke all the time.
Yeah, I have plenty of content for Vietnamese people.
are you a foodie?
It goes up and down, depending on my financial standing in life during the moment. I'm definitely a foodie when I was working in big tech, and they paid for multiple Michelin star restaurants. And so, as we've both said, food always tastes better when it's free.
It definitely does. And I think I'm a foodie, mostly because I'm a former fat kid. Great flavors just really like activate all the pleasure centers in my brain. And I think like during my 20s, when I came out and I started to be a part of the scene, I lost a little bit of weight, and then I had sort of like a nefarious relationship to food. I dieted it way too much, which led to binge eating like 2 nacho plates in one sitting in the Castro after every night out, basically. It may have been a borderline disordered eating. But since the pandemic, I think I've found a much healthier relationship to food. There's irony in saying that because I'm actually starving right now because I'm intermittent fasting.
Didn't you last time talk about intermittent fasting was when you just figured out that you had some disordered eating?
I think the intermittent fasting is fine because there's like research to back up why it's good.
So it's not 2 days of fasting.
Yeah. One time someone mentioned to me that he does 48 hours of fasting a week. And I'm like, oh, I'll try that. Then I realized that's sort of disordered eating.
Yeah, I think also as I got gayer, I developed an unhealthy relationship also through body dysmorphia. And I definitely learned or relearned through the pandemic since I had to force myself to learn to cook better. I remember in 2021, I thought I caught my first COVID because it was pre-vaccine, but because my dinner tasted so bad. And a few minutes later, I figured out it was just actually disgusting. So at that point, I had no choice but to attempt to make tastier food for myself from social media, which brings up our guest who knows a thing or two about food.
First of all, he's a real chef, but also he's America's Gaysian chef sweetheart.
In fact, his drag name could be Pad Thai LaBelle, Felicia Keys, Stephanie Curry.
These are so ridiculous. He's Chinese though, so do you have like a Chinese one?
Let me look through my list. I've got Edith P.F. Chang's.
That's terrible. How and why do you have so many of these names prepared?
It's 15 years of the Rice Raquettes and trying to come up with names for our sisters. You know, we've got the famed Rice Raquette sisters, Lychee Minnelli, Lulu Ampia, and Sushi Rolita. Oh, God. Even our good friend, LA superstar, Miss Shumai, and Vancouver delight, Lulu Lomaine. There's just something rather popular with Asian drag queens that love being named after foods.
Like, don't forget kimchi.
Kimchi.
The most famous food.
Superstar.
So Chef John Kung is going to join us on the podcast. You might know him from TikTok or YouTube or the podcast One for the Table. And his first cookbook is coming out on October 31st called Kung Food.
And you better pre-order it. You can find a link in our show notes to help drive up Gaijins on the bestseller list.
So let's hear more about him. Let's hear about his new book. And let's start the show.
Yes.
Literally Gaijins.
Literally Gaijins.
Hi, John. Welcome to Literally Gaijins.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
It's good to have you.
It's good to be here. Also, Chris, I just want to say Edith P.F. Chang's is great, but Edith Pilaf was right there.
Oh, yeah. Missed a golden opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where are you joining us from, John?
I'm at home in Detroit right now. So this is like my office studio. This is where I do all of my video editing. It's a very serene space because it's a lot better than anything. If this was just an actual light, I would just be in a Detroit basement. But yeah, no, this is like my creative space where I do all my video edits and my voiceovers.
It looks very zen.
And you have the gay lighting. Yeah, I love it.
We got the bisexual lighting going over here.
Yes,
you do.
Yeah.
And you have your dog in the back.
Yes, and Boba is in the back. We went on a...
Boba.
Yeah, she is completely unconscious right now because I took her on her first 8.7 mile run.
You did an 8.7 mile run this morning already?
Yeah. Well, I'm in the East Coast time, so we've had a full day already.
Oh, I still just got up.
Yeah, I know.
We're both unemployed, so what day and time is it anyway? I'm happy you actually made this.
It's okay. Content creators don't know what day it is either.
That's what we are. We're content creators.
Sure.
Now.
Sure. We're content creators.
So we're all friends, and we met through the esteemed, world-renowned drag queen, foodie queen, Kimchi. So John, tell us about the time we met. I want to hear it from you.
Oh, I remember it so well. It was for Kimchi's birthday. And for the trip, she hyped everybody up so much because of her previous experience. I think it was the time that she hung out with you guys last was the time that she almost missed a flight to a gig because she was partying so hard. And
I think
so
she changed
I
the
was
flight
very
a couple
excited
times.
Because I'd never done anything like that before. And was it a Joshua Tree? It was the first Joshua Tree trip. It was you guys, Kim, Naomi, and I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, it was amazing. It was such a great time. And if anybody wants to like hear about what we got up to, just listen to the Sibling Rivalry podcast and listen to Monet talk about visiting Mesopotamia, and you can get an idea of what it was like.
I remember that Mesopotamia trip. I held her up during that.
Yeah, right.
So what was it like coming into a room full of, I think there were like 10 of us, and like a whole weekend.
All strangers.
We had never met before, and then it was like an extended weekend of partying, and honestly, I was down for it. I trusted Kim's judgment in people, which I think it's one of her best. People who know Kim understand this to be a quality that she has, where she's just like a very good, she has very good judgment of other people, and she has a knack of bringing really interesting, cool, and kind people together. And so even though we hadn't been obviously we hadn't been friends back then as long as we were now, but like even back then I was like, okay, I can do this, let's just do this. And it was great.
And I remember when you showed up, we were all just like, what a babe. Who is this guy?
No, I think you guys were judging my boots or shoes.
Okay. No, we were not thinking about your shoes.
No. I think Rob did, because it was a pair of leather high tops in the desert. And it was like literally a gift pair of shoes that Kim had just given me before the trip. And so I was like, I'm going to wear these. And then I'm in the desert.
In 100-degree weather.
Yeah. Yep.
And I remember you cooked breakfast for all of us. So we didn't just party. We did have one meal.
No, we did. We weren't hungry.
We tried.
We did our best.
I still have the video of you making that food for us. It was like you were wearing the shortest crop top making eggs. And that was all the way back in 2019. And then a few months after that, the pandemic hit. All of our lives changed, but yours especially.
Was it?
You really?
Mm-hmm. 2019 or was it 2018?
Yeah.
I think we did like 20. Wow.
Yeah. I thought it was 2018. It was 2019. I know, because me and my ex had just broken up, and then we had a I forgive you moment.
I remember that.
Because I was going to move to LA.
Yes.
So I think it was 2019.
That was also, it made meeting you for the first time very memorable.
We kept on insisting, there's not going to be any weird energy. Won't be any weird energy.
But yeah, as you said, the pandemic changed a lot of people's lives, everybody's lives, some more so than others, and then certainly mine. It was weird that you guys met me through Kim, and Kim was already top of her game in this line of work of being somebody who is a content creator, influencer, drag queen type thing. When we first met, that was not anything that I was going for at all. I had no interest in it. I didn't know it was a thing for me. Mm-hmm. And then the pandemic hit. And then I think it was the next time we saw each other, I was like, yeah, this is kind of what I do now a little bit. I feel like the next time we hung out, TikTok was still it was big, but people didn't know how big it was going to get. And by the third time we got together, it was just like, yeah, Kim and I have a podcast together. This is what we do. My whole life is different now.
Well, how did that all happen? The taking off on Instagram?
It happened really during the lockdown, right? So we were all stuck in our homes, no matter where in the country we were. We didn't know what was going on. There was just an overarching feeling of fear and dread and uncertainty. And I was already on TikTok just watching. Before even the pandemic was on, I had joined TikTok shortly after it switched from being Musical.ly. And I would go every couple of weeks, I would scroll past maybe four or five videos and being like, I don't get it. This isn't for me. Everyone here is a child, but there is something special about this. I don't quite understand what yet. So I'm just going to keep checking back every few weeks and seeing what becomes of it. And then as time went by, I noticed, older people are joining. It's not just it was a lot of dancing and singing and lip syncing stuff before. And it started becoming, I noticed, cosplayers. And I enjoy watching people. I love seeing the creativity of cosplay for the very same reason why I love watching people in drag. It was very much the same thing. I love the creativity, the craft of it. So I never do it myself because I don't have patience, but watching that. And then things got, there were some political TikTokers that started going on. And I don't think I was following anyone who was doing food yet. Mm-hmm. I started cooking on TikTok before I saw cooking on TikTok. And that was during the lockdown. And the reason why I did that was because everybody on TikTok was a bunch of mostly younger people talking about how scared they were. And I was like, well, shit, what can I do? And I was like, well, I can teach them how to deconstruct a chicken for soup. I can teach them how to make a frittata. I can teach them how to stretch beans. Like the world is ending. I can teach them how to survive with as little as they possibly can. Because when you work at a restaurant, that's every day. And so that's when I really started to blow up, was like doing cooking videos. And then once things got a little less doom and gloom, we were able to go grocery shopping and stuff. I had by that time become comfortable on video. My first few videos, I refused to speak. I was like, I hated the sound of my old voice. I didn't want to talk. I just wanted to just do these like hands only, very BuzzFeed foodie type videos, just with really bad production. Then I started talking. Once I started getting more comfortable, I started to show off the things that I was doing, like my dinners that I was doing, the Miyazaki dinners I was doing in Detroit, where I would do like themed sit down tasting menus in the city of Detroit. And I was like, well, let's just
so cool.
Show these anime inspired foods and take videos of me making these old recipes again. And then it really blew up. And then I got my first brand partnership with Funimation. And then I realized, oh my God, this is a career. And then after a few of those, and I realized that within the span of like a couple months, I made more money than I. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear my dog.
Oh,
but she's, yeah. Just give me a second. Hey, shush. When I realized that in a couple of months I had made more. When I realized I had in a couple of months made more money than I had made as a line cook in an entire year, I was like,
wow,
I'm gonna stick with this. And if nothing comes out of it, well, something's already come out of it. But like, if it doesn't last past the pandemic, I can always go back to food. Mm-hmm. And it definitely lasted past the pandemic. It's definitely just what I do now.
So you're telling us you're the originator of the TikTok food review voice?
No. I mean, the storytelling food TikTok, like, I will take some credit for it. But I think it was kind of jointly created at the same time by both me and Joanne Molinaro, the Korean vegan.
Oh, I love the Korean vegan.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were one of the first food social media things I followed. I used to refuse to follow those like hands over a bowl ones because they were also so cheesy. And you were the only one on TikTok that I followed.
Yeah, I think those are just called hands and pans. Those are called hands and pans or hands only.
It's like the music I listen to.
I think of the crazy, insane TikTok voices, you know, the ones that review restaurants. Like, you guys do you guys love burritos?
The best restaurant to go right now is Carbone. And if you can't get a table, you might as well kill yourself.
It's always those. They're so unhinged, which is why we love yours. And I don't know who originated that other voice.
I don't know either, but I'm kind of here for it. It's when videos are just like straddle that line of like, are they serious or is this parody? Like, those are my favorite ones because I'm both entertained and infuriated. Where I'm angry, but I'm entertained, so of course I'm sticking around. It's like the best tweets. You can't tell if they're parody or not.
Have you always wanted to work in food? Like, how did it become such a big part of your life?
I was never afraid of being in the kitchen. I was never afraid of like trying things in the kitchen. I was making dishes. In a sense, I was making dishes long before I actually knew how to cook. Mm-hmm. My poor undergrad roommates. I spent my undergrad like in a house with a couple of other artists, and you know, I would just be making stuff without really knowing how to cook. I only set the burner to high on our electric stove. I like never followed directions. I understood that things needed to be hot enough so everything that needed to die in the food would die so people wouldn't get sick. But like, I would just be making these concoctions. And because we were undergrad people and I was just using like pre-made Meyer's sauces from the Asian aisle, like I thought I knew what I was doing. I did not know what I was doing. Everything just tasted like hoisin sauce. But I think because of that, and because I had encouragement from people who literally had no better options available to them, once it came time for me to actually teach myself how to cook, which I would do while I was in law school.
You were in law school.
Yes, that's right. When I was in law school, teaching myself how to cook properly was the only creative outlet that I could justify spending time away from studying on. Mm-hmm. While I was studying law, I was also teaching myself classic Cantonese cooking, Cantonese American cooking mostly, but also like Cantonese home recipes, steamed fish and all that stuff. And yeah, it was basically just all done through research and self-study, and also trying to cook the things that I loved eating when I was back home in Hong Kong. Because living in Detroit, you don't have those options available to you, even in restaurants. I imagine if I lived in New York or Los Angeles, I might have never, ever tried learning how to cook because I wouldn't have needed to.
It's also available to you.
Yeah.
I mean, I live in K-Town. I've lived in SoCal or like San Francisco all my life. And there's still those 5 to 10 dishes that my mom makes that I have to call her that they never carry in any kind of Vietnamese restaurant.
Yeah, as the home cooking is, especially for Asian home cooking. So a lot of them take so much time, so much labor, so much effort that it's just like not practical to do in a commercial setting. So a lot of those dishes like are just really special to us at home. Or they're super simple and nobody assumes that anyone would ever eat them outside of their house.
Yeah, I think what drew me towards your videos was how uniquely Cantonese-American these mashups were that I only knew as a kid. And then I was seeing for the first time again on the internet. And that's why I started watching those, because I never could learn them from my mom because she has severe ADHD. She can't teach me a recipe. And so you describe yourself as a third culture kid. What does that mean? How does that inform the food that you show on social media?
So just based on knowing the both of you and knowing who you guys are, like we're all third culture kids. We all grew up with a solid cultural foundation that is based on that of our parents' culture. Mm-hmm. And outside of that was a completely separate culture of what it is to be in the United States. You both grew up in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. For me, it was the US and Canada. And so, you know, it's such a cliche at this point, or at least to me it is, because I'm perpetually on TikTok and everything seems to be like 3 years ahead when it comes to culture. But it seems like a cliche now where you say like, oh, I cross a cultural threshold by like stepping through my front door every morning, where it's like, for me, just very, very Chinese inside my home. And on the outside, it was either very Canadian or very American. In my case, like, you know, North York in Toronto and then the Midwest in Michigan. So, you know, it's complete immersion. It's complete cultural immersion with two very different cultures where we had to grow up and develop in. And with immersion comes understanding of nuance in so many different ways. And how that translates creatively, in my case, third culture cooking, is that nuanced understanding of like what the food is like in both places, and having that in-depth understanding of how people enjoy that food, you can use that as a leg to create completely unique dishes of your own. And like some really good examples of that is a lot of the stuff that you see made by younger people in K-Town. They do a lot of these intricate fusions. A lot of Japanese American like cafes are very much like this, where it's like, it's not just fusion where somebody is just like, oh, I'm a white male chef who studied French culinary, and I'm using soy sauce for the first time in a very novel way. It's more like, oh, I grew up Korean and I lived in a city that was surrounded by Mexicans, and I love Mexican food and Korean food. And now here is a dish that presents an understanding of what both people actually like. Mm-hmm. And how and both people can actually appreciate. To me, that is what third culture cuisine is, as opposed to just basic fusion.
It's a brand new dish.
It is. It's something that's brand new but familiar to two completely separate groups of people.
Yeah, or like when you're on TikTok and you see like Latino families bringing tortillas to the Korean barbecue.
Oh my God.
That's amazing.
I'm going to start doing that. That's like the best thing.
It is. It is. And in California, you're starting to see like in like the suburbs of San Gabriel Valley, a lot of like younger Chinese people are opening these like really interesting concepts of foods. I went to one where it's like basically Joshua Tree, you're in tents, but it's a skewer restaurant. And in Orange County, where all of the Vietnamese Americans are, in Garden Grove and Little Saigon, there's a lot of like new interesting shops opening up, mostly from like the newer immigrants from Vietnam. It's less like fusion food, but more like these are some new dishes that like some Vietnamese people came up with in the last 10 years, like dishes and stuff that are just so delicious. And you also see something that was so staunchly in like that foundational cultural culture, like say like 15 years ago, fish sauce was really just Asian to me.
Yeah.
And then slowly moves toward third culture. Then it can slowly move toward like the dominant culture in whatever city or country you're living in.
Yeah.
And to see like that just happen in like the span of 30 years is just kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's wild. And it's so nice to see like that it had been happening in like the culinary world or I guess the professional culinary world a little bit more quickly. But thanks to TikTok, normalizing it in everyday home cooking will ultimately help everyone out because people will just be used to the concept.
When you see chili sauce and fish, like fancy fish sauce, like sriracha as a Black Friday deal at Nordstrom's, like,
you know they made it. Yeah, exactly. You have assimilated. Congratulations.
Well, I want to go back to one thing. So you're self-taught or did you go to culinary school?
So I'm self-taught. And I guess the definition of that was like, I taught myself how to cook first. And then those skills got me jobs at not only my own pop-up restaurant, which I was doing shortly after I had taught myself how to cook. But I also started working for a lot of chefs in Detroit who at that point in time were about to open their own restaurants, which hadn't been built yet because it was like a first wave of new development in the city. And people were like, well, we need hands that could cook. So I got hired because of that. And that not only got me jobs at restaurants, private kitchens, led to me opening my own kitchen. And I worked the line for like a couple of years over a spread of time for other restaurants. So I never went to culinary school. And I also didn't really like start from the bottom at any given restaurant, which is another very common way to learn how to be a cook. I just was fortunate enough to be good enough that I just got a job.
So you were in law school. You learned how to... Where's law come into this?
Okay, so I taught myself how to cook while I was in law school. And then I got my degree. In law. I got my law degree. And then I was working for the prosecutor's office as an intern for my last 2 years of law school. And then the summer after, I failed the bar exam by 3 points.
Oh, no.
All that studying, 3 points.
And then I took the bar exam again, and it was like a really messed up year where I think like half the amount of people that took the bar exam failed in Michigan. And I failed that one by 2 points.
Oh,
and then
gosh.
My ex broke up with me, and I blacked out for like a month, and I came out of it with a yoga teacher certification. and then I also got like, and also after that, I got a call from my supervisor at the prosecutor's office, and she had offered me a job, even though I'd failed the bar exam. She was like, oh, you know, you'll get it. I mean, she was like, well, you got it off by 3 points the first time, it's 2 points the first, the second time, you've either got, you'll either pass or you have one more to go. So I got a job mm-hmm. offer for it. And I said, no, I'm going to stay being a cook. Cause I was doing that all throughout as well. I'm going to stay in food. I feel like my place is in food, even though there was obviously more security in being an attorney. And that was pretty much it. I was pretty much, after that, I was like this renegade cook bouncing from pop-up to pop-up and opening and working in just random parts of the city, opening up in like abandoned storefronts, inside a letterpress, in museums. We were just serving food pretty much anywhere we could.
And this is on top of you having a theater degree.
Yeah.
The theater degree is helping, right?
Oh, totally. A lot more than the law degree. Yeah, no. The theater kid to TikToker pipeline is very real. It's going to be hard. Like, if you have a favorite content creator on TikTok, chances are they know a little bit of musical theater.
Oh, yeah. We're Broadway gays, so we appreciate that.
100%.
It's just funny hearing that story because, like, I think of people who do traditionally professional career routes or in school and then choosing something they finally love. I feel like in my head, there's, like, this magical moment where you just have faith and it happens. But I've been researching this a lot and, like, listening because, like, me and Don Jar are both fun employed and we're like, maybe you go back to the same jobs, maybe we switch things up, but having the faith to do the switching things up is hard. But the more I like kind of research and hearing your story, I feel like it's more like happy accidents.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's where the pandemic ultimately kicked mm-hmm. in. It provided so many people with, in a sick and twisted way, a safety net or a security blanket. To pursue these things mm-hmm. without the fear of any kind of repercussion of taking a career risk because we weren't doing anything anyway. There was no FOMO because the world had literally stopped. So that's why you have a lot of food content creators now that came up through TikTok, that came up through the food scene, but also like Joanne Molinaro, who was a partner lawyer at her firm in Chicago. And you had people who, electric engineers, people who are, like there were people, I'm not naming names, but there are like famous TikTokers who were pretty much all but homeless. Mm. And now they're like bi-coastal rich.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because of TikTok. Like it's wild because of TikTok and the pandemic.
To bring it back to like this, the identity pot when you were talking about third culture, I'm curious, does the word Gaijin connect with you at all?
Oh, 100%. I think queerness, obviously the Asian / Chinese part of me is a huge part of my culinary identity. And there are some people who, there are a lot of gay people, gay cooks in not proper culinary. There are a lot of gay cooks in food media. And as mm-hmm. I have come to find out, there are a lot of lesbians in the professional culinary scene. Mm-hmm. But in gay media itself, like, you know, there are people that try to, there is a division on whether or not like there's a queerness to food when it's cooked by queer people. Mm-hmm. I am of the camp that says queerness when it comes to creativity is always inherent in any kind of creative output, because when you are queer, you are automatically just that much more free in your expression. Mm-hmm. So I think people who live a conventional path in life, like they have a pretty regular starting point on how they view the creative process. But because of our fearlessness in expression, I think queer people start at a 5 as opposed to a 1. Mm-hmm. And
I like that.
Queer creative people, I should say. They start at a 5. Everybody has the ability to get to a 10, but queer creatives, just because they don't have that inherent like fear of holding back because they had been hiding for so long. And so we just express a little bit stronger and we start a little bit more boldly. And that translates to anything that has creative output, and that includes food.
there's less walls to climb over to get to the truth.
Yep. We're not afraid of being a little silly.
But this is a question that we've asked several guests, however you want to answer it. Like, mm-hmm. when was actually the first time that you felt, quote unquote, like Gaysian?
Gaysian.
That's a good question. I'd probably say it was like once after I had hung out with you guys that first time.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Because I didn't really have a gay Asian group, friend group. I had a small one when I was in Hong Kong, but I would only see them like once every few years. And I still do have maintained friends from that group. But we don't see each other often enough to look for me to feel like I'm part of something. But of course, after the partying that we did, who can't feel like you're not a part of anything?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you all know too much. So yeah, we're a family now.
or a cult. Yeah.
But apart from that, like my day-to-day life does not really include, and it's by no choice of mine, but it does not include a lot of Asian people. I mean, Detroit is not really known for a large Asian population, mm-hmm. let alone a queer one. There are a few of us. There are literally a few of us. When you ask me about Asians in Detroit, I see individual faces of people that I've met, mm-hmm. not bars of people, groups of people. So it was very limiting. And to see people like y'all and people like Kevin, who blew my mind when he told me he was sixth generation.
It still blows our mind.
Yeah, sixth generation. So it's like there are potentially like Chinese people who are great-great-grandparents who know less Chinese than I do. Mm-hmm. And that blows my mind. And like just never having grown up in that kind of community, like, you know, I truly kind of felt like, oh, okay, this is what it's meant to be both things at the same time. I've always been queer. I've always been Asian, but I very rarely had the opportunity to have both of those worlds meet. And it's really cool whenever I get the chance for that to happen.
Well, you're welcome. Okay, so now just gonna fast forward. You have a few exciting weeks ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
You're coming out with a cookbook. How's that feel? Tell us about it.
It feels crazy. Writing a book, at least to me, feels like, and I don't know if either you guys might have been good students. I certainly was not when I was younger. But did you ever feel like that looming pressure of long-term homework on you? Like somebody gave you like an assignment that was like an extended assignment, mm-hmm. and you might have waited too long, and there's just like this weight that's over you
all the time.
Mm-hmm. It's like that, but for 2 years and as an adult. I took a year to write this book, and then there are still things about it that I'm still like working on or like doing the final touches on right now. For example, like my book has like a few QR codes, and when you scan your phone over parts of the book, it'll send you to a YouTube video where I illustrate what is in the book. So like a lot of dumpling folding, which is very, very difficult to explain in using just written words. You can scan the QR code, and it was like, we're just going to go over, and it sends you to a private video that is only attached to the book.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was we're going to learn how to fold these together. So I'm still working on that right now. The video has been shot, but they needed to be edited and uploaded.
And are you doing that all yourself?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Another part about writing a book is like, it really is as isolating as people would imagine. Even as a person who I've never written professionally in my life, never got paid for a single word I had ever put on a page before this book. Still, it's just like getting a book deal. It's like, hey, that's great. Here's your first installment. Good luck. I was like, okay.
Last time we saw you, you were saying that you hadn't had a vacation since the 1 year before we last saw you.
Yeah. The last time I took a trip that was like all for fun was with the last time that I was with you guys. And the thing is like, yes, that is not a very... I spent that year writing a book, maintaining a YouTube channel and being a TikToker. So it was like very little time that I had to actually like have off. But it was all stuff that was like, the book will eventually be finished. The YouTube mm-hmm. will eventually be something that is coasting. TikTok will eventually be something that like calms down a little bit. So I knew I was like maintaining a sprint for a really long time, but I knew that there was an end to it. And it is, and it's worth it. The work that I put into everything, I'd say, was definitely worth it. And I also had a very supportive partner who is also a workaholic and also works from home. So even though we work all the time, we always see each other. And so like, there's a lot of factors that make, I guess, this less than ideal work-life balance something that isn't too bad. The fact that you can do it from home, the fact that you're never too far from the people you love when you do it, I think I wouldn't do it forever, but I could do it for a while.
And you're also doing something that you love.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's in your book? What is this creative brainchild that you skipped taking the bar exam for the third time?
So some of the recipes in the book, well, the first chapter of the book is actually a lot of like basic sauces. Mm. So like ginger scallion oil, there's chili favorite. Crisp in there. Because the ultimate thesis of the book is third culture. And that means cross-cultural cuisine, which means my ultimate goal is for people to kind of take this book as an inspiration to create completely unique dishes of their own. Like it would be such a dream of mine to see somebody who was Mexican or Nigerian or Korean or Vietnamese to like take those sauces and then like apply those basic Chinese sauces to their own food and then hopefully tag me on Instagram so I can see it and maybe make it for myself. After those sauces are some like easier snacks, but then at the last chapter are like me taking those concepts as far as I could go at the time under the context of Chinese American food. So basic sauces in the front, and then it gets a little less basic. So it goes from like chili oil to a chorizo chili oil. And then you go through, and then I teach you how to make Portuguese bread. And in there we do a spam ginger scallion egg lettuce and tomato sandwich, and then it goes all the way to like don don lasagna. I teach you how to make lion's head meatballs, the really big lion's head meatballs. We go through like a traditional Cantonese preparation of the soup, but on the other page it's taking those meatballs and putting it on a plate of spaghetti, because a giant cartoonishly large meatball on a plate of spaghetti was something that I always like enjoyed the concept as a child, because I saw it in TV cartoons, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, that kind of thing. And then Hong Kong style chicken and waffles, so using like egget waffles with karaage chicken. There's also like a chipotle mango sweet and sour pork orange chicken that's made with like orange soda that is like local to Detroit called Fago, like a Fago orange chicken. So a lot of things that were just like either inspired by my locale or just me playing with the concept of like, what would have happened to Chinese American food if we weren't held back with the stigma of what Chinese American food was? Mm-hmm. What if we were allowed to like be creative with it all the time? So, and that had like so many just different sources of inspiration. But it ultimately ended up with something that I think is pretty fun.
It's like if Amy Tan wrote her cookbook.
Nice.
I really should not have waited to intermittent fast while doing this episode. I am so starving listening to you list off all the recipes.
I remember so many of your videos kept me well fed during lockdown. And as you're well known for championing frozen dumplings so much, I ate so many dumplings, covered in different toppings, like the enchilada sauce, the blended veggies that you're about to throw away, and my favorite, the Japanese curry sauce.
Oh my God, that was so good.
Did these make it into the book?
They did not. They didn't, but at the same time, I still encourage very heavily the use of pre-made frozen dumplings in my book. I think there is like definitely a mention of just like throwing them in there, because that's my default meal when I'm tired, when I'm not tired, when I like it. It's always something that like I've got in the freezer and I'm always happy to eat. And then just throwing that together with whatever Japanese curry or sag or enchilada sauce or vodka sauce, everything is better with dumplings that you like just pulled out of a freezer and boiled really quickly.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
All right, to celebrate your new cookbook, we're going to ask you for some hot, quick takes, and we're going to participate too. So are you ready, John?
Yes.
First topic, I know something that you and Doncha will have a hot take on.
Oh, God.
First topic, MSG.
Oh, my God. You go first.
Well, what's the take? Am I pro MSG? Because obviously, yes.
Yeah, what's your take on it?
Well, okay, so I mean, like, I don't even feel... It's gotten to the point, MSG has gotten to the point where it's like, it shouldn't be, it's so like not a take for me anymore, because a take could be right or wrong. And people who are just anti-MSG are just like scientifically wrong. Mm-hmm. And they're just based off of like ignorance, fear mongering, and just like the nastiest part of the wellness industry. So I'm just like, if you disagree with me on the subject that MSG is like, and there's nothing harmful about MSG unless you have way too much of it, which is possible, but you can have way too much of salt in the very same way. If you come at me with like anti-MSG rhetoric or something like that, like that's not opinion. That's just being wrong. And I am going to literally make a character judgment on you based on that. So
it's pretty racist probably. Yeah.
I mean, it is based on xenophobia and racism, bad science. And that's the reason why it's okay to judge people poorly based off of that.
Yeah. I'm always surprised because I think I was on the same page as you, where I feel like people should know by now, but they don't, unless you call it umami. That's the new...
Yeah.
That's when it's allowed, umami. Yeah.
I'm like, meanwhile, natural flavors has been the secret ingredient cover for MSG in Western processed foods since MSG became like something that was shunned. They just changed it to natural flavoring, and that's all that it is. So everybody had been eating it the whole time. So yes, I make a judgment call whenever I come across this argument.
Tomatoes.
God. Yeah.
So I think I've evolved on the topic, but I would like to present a different origin story. That it's not just xenophobia, because it has been something passed down from generations of my family since Vietnam. And I grew up from my parents saying, oh, you're getting a bad stomach after that bowl of pho at the restaurant because they put too much MSG. And in Vietnam, some people just believe MSG is bad. I don't know if it's taken from, there's the xenophobic roots informed that, but I grew up in a household where the Asian people told me that the MSG was bad. And why I've evolved on the topic is because once I said something like on a group chat with Doncha here, with Chris here, and I was like, I got a bad stomach after eating something in like San Jose, like probably the MSG.
Because your food was bad.
Yes, probably because my food is bad, but all caps, Chris Doncha style, like, that is so racist. And I'm like, what? It is? Like, I have grown up with that.
It's actually very easy to tell when your food has too much MSG in it, because people don't realize that MSG, when there's too much MSG in food, it actually, there is a very strong taste. It tastes like a ramen packet because that is the highest concentration. So you can have anything from fries to chips or anything. If it tastes like Doritos or a ramen packet, that's how you know there's too much MSG in it. And even then, that's not necessarily enough MSG to make you sick. That's just, it's like putting too much salt in something. Like, I no longer taste the food, I just taste the salt. I no longer taste the food, I taste the MSG. I mean, I feel like when it comes to receiving that kind of stigma from within our communities, like, that stigma was imported. Like, it wasn't Asian people that had anything to against, like, this product. It was from probably a Western influence.
Yeah, my dad still believes it. My dad still thinks, or he still goes to the pho restaurant that says no MSG, or he tries to cook without the MSG. My mom, she lives in, been in Vietnam or back in Vietnam for 6 years now, and so she's all about the MSG. She's like, even when you make the dipping sauce with fish sauce for your spring rolls, she's like, you have to put a little MSG in it to bring it all together.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah. I think, don't you call me out once. He's like, well, I've seen you cook pho before, and you use the mushroom powder, don't you? I'm like, yeah. Well, that, do you know that's a little bit of MSG? And then I think what really sealed the deal for me was like, okay, I love these jalapeno cheddar Cheetos. And I'm like, what do they put in this that's so good? It's then I realized, mystery. What is monosodium glutamate? Oh, it's in a lot of all these. It's literally in every chip.
Yeah.
Every great chip. And then I started noticing it on Doritos, on Pringles and everything. And oh.
If you take regular restaurant tortilla chips and then you put MSG on it, tell me it doesn't taste like Doritos. Like that's what they are.
Best chip. Okay, yeah. Next one. What's your current food obsession?
My current food obsession. I had just gotten off my tomato sandwich kick.
I saw that video.
Yeah. All, like the 3 weeks worth of, for whatever reason, I had realized that it was the end of tomato season in Michigan, and I had not eaten a single tomato sandwich, which is my favorite thing to eat.
I love it.
During the tomato season in Michigan, because when it's good tomatoes, that's really all you need. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to make this a series, and I'm going to make myself a tomato sandwich every day with tomatoes from my friends' like farms and gardens, and just see what I can do with it. Because, like, you know, some people can be purists and be like, oh, tomatoes, mayo, white bread, salt and pepper, and that's all you need. I was like, well, if I'm going to eat it every day, I'm going to take creative license on this thing because I don't want to eat the same thing every day.
Which was your favorite variation of the tomato
my
sandwich?
My favorite variation, toum. There was one with toum, which is the Lebanese garlic sauce.
That Lebanese garlic sauce. Good.
And it was so, so very good. That one and the curry one were excellent. I did a curry tomato sandwich where I did like a curry fried butter, put that into a mayonnaise, and then put a tomato on that. And then I did the toum. I do end it. It's been posted on YouTube already. It hasn't been posted on Facebook yet or IG Reels yet. But somebody sent me caviar to put in a tomato sandwich. I made a caviar tomato sandwich. And that thing, like, the fact that it wasn't automatically the best, like, toum was still really good. But that one was, like, a solid number two. Like, if it was, I highly recommend putting caviar on a tomato sandwich if you have the opportunity to, because that was amazingly good. Not just novel, it was good. But again, now that I'm coming off of that, I'm feeling like as it gets colder, if it ever gets colder, I should say, it's still not that cold. I really think like it's going to be a rising of the grilled cheese.
Ooh.
So good.
Yeah. I was completely obsessed with the tomato sandwich when kimchi actually turned me onto it.
Yeah. That was like last year, I think. She saw the glory of the tomato sandwich.
And it was just a simple recipe. And when I worked at the tech company I used to work at, and I think for like 2 weeks straight, every lunch, I just kept making it. And my 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 boss actually asked me, are you on some sort of weird diet? Is this some new Gwyneth Paltrow thing where you need to be on a sandwich?
That's awesome.
Like, yeah. And everyone was like, there's Bao making his tomato sandwich with the mayonnaise again. So
the funny thing is, like, I get a lot of nasty comments on YouTube from people that have never had a proper good tomato sandwich. Mm. It's shockingly aggressive and actually quite classist. A lot of those things like, oh, this looks poor as hell. And I was like, we'll just wait till you see the caviar video. But but yeah, there are a lot of people that, A, really don't like tomatoes, don't understand that tomatoes can taste good by themselves on bread and then I get comments like, oh, where's the lettuce and tomato? Where's the lettuce and bacon? There are lots of shocking amount of people that, you know, have not ever had a good tomato sandwich and probably will not have one, which is so weird because it's like not expensive.
It's also you just need to get them in tomato. Season.
Yeah.
Bao, in your intermittent fasting, do you have like a current food obsession?
I'm like fucking drooling at this point. it's like going out the corner of my mouth. My current food obsession is the instant abalone porridge, Korean porridge.
Ooh, yeah.
That comes in like a packet that you need to literally just like tear open halfway and heat for 2 minutes.
Is that H-Mart?
I've seen that at the Chinese grocery store, and I thought about getting it.
It's the BB Go is the brand I like. So I got my COVID booster, and I was like, whenever I get my COVID booster, it's every excuse to eat any comfort food I have for like 2 or 3 days. And so I was like, I feel like a congee, but what's going to keep? And I saw, and I know this is my favorite, so I bought like 5 packs, just like leave in my pantry or whatever. I finished it in 2 days.
Did you get the latest booster shot?
I did. The booster always gets me.
Did you feel anything? Like, I didn't feel anything for this one. My arm was sore and literally there was nothing else.
I felt into it now. Bad for like a day, but I just kept giving myself the permission to eat the comfort food for like 3 or 4 days. I'm like, I'm sick. I'm doing my part.
God, those sound so good. My stupid obsession is the Marie Callender chicken pot pie. Don't hate me. It's so processed, but it makes me so happy.
That chicken pot pie was an inspiration for one of the recipes in the book. And I made a beef and broccoli pot pie. Well, actually in a skillet because I used to love those so much as a child. So no, your feelings are valid.
And my favorite thing as a kid was I added rice to it because I didn't think they were big enough and I didn't want to eat two, but then I actually would end up eating two and I would put rice in both of them.
That is genius because that like creamy chicken gravy on rice is so good. You know what? It probably scratched the same itch as like the Hong Kong mushroom cream sauce on rice. Ooh, do you remember those?
And then also the fried fish with corn cream sauce over rice.
Yes. We love to put those on rice. So naturally that Mary Callender. See, you're already doing third culture shit.
All right. Okay.
you better do that later and tag him.
Right. I'm going to start my own cooking show. How to bastardize a dish that I love as a child.
Was it called Pan in Hand? Hand Pan? What is it
hands
called?
In Pans.
You could do Hands in Pan, Marie Callender, chicken pot pie rice.
But can you do like a Korean vegan style, like, you know, voiceover while you do it though?
Oh, you have to come with a story.
That soothing airy voice.
Soothing voice and a story.
Yeah. When I was laid off.
No, I'll just stick with my world-weary drag queen voice with a cigarette hanging it out of my mouth.
Best. Oh,
no one's doing that. No one's doing that yet. So, all right, next take. Give us an unpopular opinion on a popular food item.
I have the thought that like pretty much anything that is expensive is already overrated. So which is funny because we just talked about putting caviar on a tomato sandwich. But like I do ultimately think, even though I did that caviar is very, very overrated. Same with truffles. I was about to say foie gras, but no, I think foie gras is actually just like appreciated as much as it normally is.
And I know you love to hate on microgreens.
Microgreens? Microgreens are just like, I don't know. They are wildly overpriced. I will agree to that because I used to use a lot of microgreens in my food. And those tiny little flowers, people don't know that that is sometimes the most expensive thing on those plates.
Really?
Yes. Yes. Those purple flowers are very expensive. Grams for gram. Huh?
How expensive can
it be? So it would be like, I think like a case of borage flowers when they had just started coming out, they would be like $30 for like 8 ounces, something.
Oh, wow.
So like just for one, just put one flower on the plate, like, you know, it would ultimately be like the most expensive. Like, girl, you can do whatever the fuck you want with that lamb, but you better eat that goddamn flower. But yeah. So like expensive food in general, I think fine dining in general, I appreciate that it exists, but I do think ultimately it is all very overrated.
Yeah. Not your jam.
Not a very hot take, I guess. Oh, I've got a better one. I got a better one. I think LA is as good of a food city as New York is.
Oh.
Mm.
I like that.
I think a lot of people would disagree with that, but I think the food that you can get in Los Angeles is on par with some of the best food that you can get in New York, and oftentimes much cheaper.
That is very important.
I'll piggyback off that. I think LA is the best food city in the US. I just think it's the, and maybe because I was raised here and any produce just hits different here.
It's true. I might actually be inclined to believe you if I just didn't dislike a majority of the rest of about what makes LA as a city.
Yeah. Let's isolate it to the food.
Yeah. If it was isolated to the food, I might agree with you that Los Angeles and the greater outlying areas do constitute as like the best cuisine that you can get in the United States. But unfortunately, because it's in LA, you know, like you can't have, gotta dock a star.
Girl, we're gonna get so much haters about that.
bring it. I listened to your podcast. I know you like, you had that bullshit about the stars on Spotify. Fuck them. If you're listening, fuck you guys. They're great. Oh.
Yeah. We've processed it. Now it's just kind of funny. Also, one last thing before we go to Do You Don't Ya, I think bell peppers are trash. Please take bell peppers off everything.
I hate bell peppers, especially in Chinese food. Like that chow mein with a bell pepper and all onions, disgusting.
I know. I still love Mexican food. I know it's in a lot of Mexican food, but I just do not like bell peppers. You know when people eat the bell peppers raw and they dip it in cream cheese or something? I'm like, who? Are you insane?
I like the red ones. I'll eat the red ones.
Yeah, colorful bell peppers, the non-green ones, more ripened.
The green bell, well, they're all the same bell pepper.
Yeah, more ripened. I'm okay. Yeah. Green, disgusting.
So
what's an unpopular food item that deserves a second opinion?
I don't really like...
Or like maybe underrated food item.
Underrated food? I mean...
I think an early version of that would be... Like your love for frozen dumplings in a way.
Frozen dumplings and tomato sandwiches, I guess. Like I think some of the best food that you can eat are like the simple ones. I think ease of making things, especially now that I've switched over from like showing off the food that I can cook to actually like trying to teach people to cook. I put a lot more value in how accessible something is to make and actually... And actually kind of like weigh that in on how good food is.
Mm-hmm. You're the people's chef.
Well, I guess. As long as I don't have to be around them.
Chris, what's your item?
Oh, gosh. I almost wanted to say the pot pie again. I'm gonna pass on this one for a bit.
Mine is fermented shrimp paste. Have you had fermented shrimp paste before? Vietnamese fermented shrimp paste?
Oh, yeah. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say sit there on the couch and have it while watching Netflix.
Oh, no. But like
it makes
for when you're, if you're making like laksa or something like that, like it, the shrimp paste. And I think like stinky food, quote unquote, stinky foods like that. Like I just have an automatic great appreciation for them because I know what they do to food. Mm-hmm. And I know what they do to some of my favorite food, like laksa. So I smell that and people might think that it's like not pleasant or something like that, but I'm sniffing that like it's like wine.
Yeah, like the stinky tofu and everything.
Or a hot guy's
socks.
Which
brings me to... which brings me... Oh, damn.
We got to feet real quick.
I think mine actually might be durian. Durian I fell in love with when I was in Asia.
So good.
Because so good. I think what's the problem with having it here is that it's not fresh. I always had it frozen. And people love to hate on it, that it smells like dead bodies. And yes, it does. But you just got to get in your mouth. We put dicks in our mouths. Other things are gross. Dicks hang in toilets. We eat ass. You're fine. Eat some fucking durian.
Kim actually explained it really well, that good durian tastes like caramelized onions. And I was like, I agree. Oh, sweet,
yeah.
And just a little bit of savory.
Yeah, my sister and my mom loved durian growing up, but they would, and I didn't. I totally hated it. And then they would store it in the freezer. And I would get so mad because when you get ice from the freezer for like a nice cold glass of water, it hit a durian. Yes. But yeah, it wasn't until Singapore where I was like, I fell in love with it. Because I think the durian just hits different in Singapore, especially during durian season. And you have to try the durian McFlurry at McDonald's in Singapore if you're there.
Ooh, I bet that's good.
So good.
Okay, but last take. Maybe that's just more of a question at this point. Asian dish to avoid when you're planning to bottom.
Nothing. Just let them deal with it. Eat what you want. I am an advocate for bottom's rights. Y'all should be
Thank
fed.
You. Yes. Thank you. There should be more.
Hashtag bottom's rights.
Just bottom's eat like right before it happens because it still takes time to get down there.
Yeah. You know what? I am a recovering...
bottom
like OCD boot doucher. Well, the douching I will do, but then when I used to hook up a lot, I just felt ridiculous. I'm like, we're in a climate crisis and I'm flushing all this water.
No, I mean, just like think of how the body works. Like if you're going on a date and you get right into it, first of all, I would be more worried about like getting fucked while feeling heavy would be more of an issue than like bottoming would be. Like it takes what, like 8 hours for food to pass through you? It's not... whatever it is you're eating, it doesn't walk like a gay. It's not going down faster just because you're gay. Like it takes time. So whatever you eat the night before. And actually, I think I have confirmation from a lot of like my friends who do porn with this. It's like, it's always what you eat the night before a shoot. And a lot of people will like fast before a shoot and then like eat nothing but yogurt or something like that and then douche.
Oh, wow.
But honestly, eat what you want. Half the times you get ghosted half the times off your Grindr hookups anyway. What are you going to do? Like be lonely and hungry? That's sad. Don't do that. Eat.
Yeah. So, no, sometimes I'm like, if you can't make it here by 8 p.m., I'm going to eat. So
yeah.
See you later. The friends who do porn, it happens all the time. They just never film it.
They just never film it. Yeah. They just never film it.
It's in the editing floor.
Yeah.
And on the bed sheets.
That is upsetting. But that's why you should always have like the towel put on the sheet. And maybe
that's
like
so unsexy though.
It is okay. I won't say I don't like it and it does ruin the mood.
It's
but
practical.
At the same time, like you should make it a point to not make people feel bad about it. And people should still like not hold back on what makes them happy.
Yeah.
So have that pizza. Eat that pad thai. Have the curry.
Have the shrimp paste. Extra shrimp paste.
Exactly. Do it.
Numbing spices all the way.
Who cares? He's just a top anyway.
Bottoms rights. Sadly, we've reached the end. We want to congratulate you on your cookbook, John. And thank you for joining us here.
Thank you for having me. This was great. It was good to see you guys again.
Yeah, we have to see each other soon. Yeah. And maybe on your book tour, because you're going to be in LA and San Francisco.
That's right. So there are no like official dates posted as of the recording of this video, but there will be a tour that goes from New York to San Francisco to Los Angeles to Chicago at the end of October. between the end of October and the first week of November. So
if people want to pre-order your book.
Yeah, my book is available as of now, already available for pre-order. You can find that link in any of my socials at John Kung, J-O-N-K-U-N-G on Instagram or YouTube or TikTok. Oh my
God. The main one.
Or TikTok. Yeah, any of those in the links in the bios will point you straight to the pre-order for the book.
Why is it important everyone pre-orders?
Pre-ordering is super important to an author and a first-time author because it's our best chance to make any bestseller lists. And also pre-orders tell bookstores how popular a book is. So physical bookstores, if they get a lot of questions and pre-orders for it, they'll put it on their window. And things like that make a huge difference. It can make or break a book. That's why we're putting so much pressure that's why there is so much pressure to do well on pre-orders. If you were going to buy the book anyway, it's not just for me, for any author that you want to support. Pre-ordering their book helps them immeasurably.
If you're listening now, we have the pre-order link in the show notes. Buy it absolutely right now. Pull over on the side of the road. Do it. And to send us off, John, what's one recipe from your upcoming book the listeners should try making first?
I would say the lion's head meatballs, because then you get a soup and spaghetti out of it.
And a big meatball.
And don't we just love a big meatball?
I love a comically large meatball.
Yes.
I want a big meatball right now.
And that was no double entendre, actually.
No, I actually really do want to know. I'll put it in a hot pot. I'll put it on rice. I'll put it in Marie Callender's pot pie. I'll do anything. Anyway, so I'm going to go eat. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.